Unveiling the secrets A-list copywriters use to make themselves and their clients millions. This is the Copywriters Podcast with your host, the world's greatest copywriting coach, David Garfinkel.
Yesterday, as we record this in late June, Facebook wiped out a bunch of groups without warning. Just wiped them out.
Big groups.
Yeah, I heard one group had 4 million people in it. Just like that, some creators lost their entire audience. Gone. That's why today we're talking about the one platform you actually own, your email list. Apparently, some of the groups were deleted by accident, by AI, and reinstated, but others were deleted permanently. Now, no one outside of Facebook's Menlo Park, California headquarters really knows why this happened, but that it did happen points to something our guest a couple of shows ago, Evelina Kagamanovich, said, having your own email list is business insurance. And it's even more true today than it was two shows ago because of the Facebook slaughter yesterday. Because again, email is the one platform you actually own. So with our heightened threat awareness, Nathan suggested we do an emergency show on our latest findings on email marketing. We'll walk you through the essentials of email marketing that actually works in 2025. I have a very fresh example to share with you. And we'll talk about subject lines that get clicks, the number one factor affecting your open rates, and the biggest mistakes we still see people making with their emails. To help you survive and thrive in these uncertain times, right after I give you the biggest thrival and survival tip of all. Copy is powerful. You're responsible for how you use what you hear in this podcast. And most of the time, common sense is all you need. But if you make extreme claims, and if you're writing offers for highly regulated industries like health, finance, business opportunity, you may want to get a legal review after you write and before you start using your copy. My larger clients do this all the time. Okay, I don't spend, you know, a lot of time bragging about my wins, but today I'm gonna for sure, because I'm part of an info product that was released this morning, and we're actually going to talk about it with the creator of this next week, John McIntyre. He's going to be on the show, but it's called AI Copywriting Secrets Volume 2. And it has a lot of superstar copywriters and, you know, people like Sam Woods and people like that on there. And I sent out an email this morning. We just opened the cart at midnight, and around 7 o'clock, I sent out an email. I'm second on the leaderboard after the formidable Daniel Throssell. And I have a small list, but it's a buyer's list, number one. Number two, they bought my book, The Persuasion Story Code, and also we send them useful, nurturing emails every week about persuasion stories. So this is all going to fall into what we're going to talk about today. But I'm feeling kind of punchy because, you know, of all the senior copywriters on there, me, John Benson, David Deutsch, Bob Bly, you know, guys, two of them I, you know, worshipped and looked up to when I first started, I'm ahead of all of them. So how about that?
Nice.
I want to savor it while it lasts because they probably haven't mailed yet, but you know.
If they're on the ball, they have. And it is a testament to email is still important. We hear email is dead. Between Facebook deleting a bunch of groups and people losing their audience immediately, and this kind of anecdotal story of bringing in a ton of sales only with one email. Email is not dead.
No, it's not dead at all. What has happened, I think, is people have cheapened it, even whether they're using AI or whether they're just phoning it in in a human way, and not putting any of themselves or, you know, their emotion or their life experience into it, that kind of email is dead. It's pretty much always been dead. I mean, it worked better in the past, but it, you know, I was fortunate enough to be unceremoniously booted off Facebook about 2 years ago. Oddly enough, right while I was delivering a seminar to Brian Kurtz's group. Coincidence? I don't know. But, I mean, do you have a Facebook group at this point, Nathan?
I do not run any Facebook groups at this point. And to be honest, I don't even frequent Facebook groups very much anymore. So this did not affect me, but it affected a lot of people that I know. You mentioned a 4 million person group. One of my friends runs a 3.5 million person group on AI and marketing, and his was one of the groups, one of the bigger ones that got deleted instantly, lost the entire audience.
Oh man. Yeah. And I don't feel so bad now. When I got unceremoniously booted off, I lost, you know, 5,000 friends. Well, that's horrible, but it's nothing like 3.5 million audience. My God.
Right. So let's jump into, if you understand, I think we've made a good point for why you should still be utilizing email. Let's jump into some of the tips on how to make your email marketing more effective.
Yeah. So before you even get into writing emails, you need to make sure people are seeing them. I think you understand the technical sides of this better than I do. I can offer one tip from my general studies brain, and that is, you don't want your from address to be a Gmail address or a Hotmail address. If you're sending to a list, if you're sending to one person, that's fine. If you're sending to a list, you want a business domain or a subdomain. I mean, that sender reputation is important, and it's not just the person you're trying to reach who's going to be looking at that reputation. There are a series of steps that you go through, and you could probably talk about those, you know, the ISPs and in the internet and all that.
A lot of the service providers, a lot of the email service providers, they will automatically ding your account if you're trying to mass email from like a Gmail account. And Gmail, if they see that you're mass emailing from a Gmail account, they'll automatically put your stuff in spam. So both on the sending side and the receiving side, if you're trying to mass email from a Gmail account or a similar account like that, you're automatically being sent straight to the spam folder. And so, yeah, it always makes more sense. Send from a professional domain, a domain that you own. And if you want to take an extra layer of protection, do it from a subdomain. Send it from mail.mywebsite.com. So Nathan@mail.mywebsite.com. That way, if you do have any kind of dings to your reputation, it only affects that subdomain. It doesn't affect your main domain. So those are two right off the bat things that you can do to protect yourself.
Okay, what about the alphabet soup that I don't really understand? The DMARC, the DKIM, the SPF?
So these are things that specifically, I think Gmail was the one that led the way on these, where if it doesn't have a DMARC or a DKIM, and now they've added the SPF, these are just little codes, text codes that you need on your website, on your server, to signify that it's a safe account. It's kind of like an encryption thing that makes it harder for people to spoof your email, because for a while there, people would be sending from mywebsite.com scam website. And then they would, when it showed up on your inbox, it would look like it was from David Garfinkel at garfinkelcoaching.com. People would open it because they're like, oh, I know David. I like David. But it was actually spoofed, and it wasn't actually coming from you, and it was clicks to malicious things. So to prevent that, they've added these extra layers of security, the DMARC, the DKIM, and now the SPF text codes that you put on your server. And it just helps make it to where people can't make an email look like it's coming from somebody who it really isn't, which that kind of leads into the other thing. As far as open goes, we spend a lot of time hyper-focused on, I need a good catchy subject line. I need a good preview text to get people to click. But the name of the sender is so important. If I know David and I see an email from David and I know every time he sends me something, it's packed with value, doesn't really matter what the subject line is. Oh, I got an email from David. I better open this. So sender is so important. And it's one of the things that we don't realize. And a lot of businesses, a lot of clients, when I come in and start working with them, they're still mailing from help@mywebsite.com or service@mywebsite.com. And the first thing that we usually have to do is, no. This needs to come from the name, the face of the company, because I'm not trying to get, I'm not trying to open an email from service. I'm trying to open an email from David.
Yeah, that's good. Let's go back to DMARC, DKIM, and SPF, now that I know how to pronounce them. Are those things that a civilian can set up, or do you need to bring in a technical person to do that for you?
Generally, when you're setting up your email in your GetResponse or your Constant Contact or something like that, MailChimp, they'll give you the codes. And then if you can go into wherever your website is hosted and you can find your text files, you can just put it in there. It does require a little bit of technical know-how. I don't think that if you're competent and you can go on Google and ask how to do it, you can figure it out, but it is frustrating. And it's, for a lot of us marketers, it's not the thing that lights us up and sets us on fire about our jobs. So if you need help, you can find help. But if you're fairly competent, you can, and you've got access to the back end of a website, you can figure it out and do it yourself.
Okay. I think there's one more thing about delivery and trust basics we should cover. Don't use that corporate looking image heavy templates. You're not sending someone a Hallmark card. You're sending a message, a communication. I mean, when you write to your brother or your friend, you don't, you know, carefully design it in, you know, some overly illustrated frame.
Yep.
Emails that are going to work need to look like a normal email from a normal person to another normal person. I don't know how else to say it. Also, when you add all that extra frosting and decorations, yeah, it triggers promo tabs. And so people might not see it, and people will start to look at it as an ad and they won't read what you're saying.
Yep. If I open up an email and it's very pretty and it's got framing and it's got all kinds of images, immediately my brain says, oh, this is an ad. Go ahead and click back. And also the algorithms over at Gmail and Hotmail and wherever, they look at it and they say, oh, this is an ad. And so we know that when most people open these, they click out of them right away. Let's just go ahead and send this one over to the spam folder because we're pretty sure it's spam.
And that's how it works. They don't give you the benefit of the doubt. All right, let's talk about subject lines and open rate psychology, right? I mean, the key thing is writing a subject line that feels human, like it was from you, as the human you, as opposed to a random human, and gets opened, right?
Yeah, and I think that the thing that marketers often forget is that email is very personal, and the things that trigger us to open an email is, the first thing is this a personal email? And so a couple of rules that I have is I don't do the all first letter of each word being capitalized like it would be in a headline. My subject lines are written just like I would write a subject line to one of my friends. I'm not going to go through and cap every single first letter of each word.
Right.
The other thing is, usually when I'm sending, if I send something to David, it's not the three things that you have to know before, it's, hey, David, check this out. And that'll be my subject line. So simple, direct, to the point, and a little bit of curiosity. Check what out? Nathan just sent me something. He says I need to check it out. I wonder what it is. So evoke that curiosity, but don't make it look like a headline for a sales page.
That's really good. And curiosity is better than clickbait. I mean, so I remember, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago, I did a little video on YouTube about why I read the National Enquirer. And this was, at that time, kind of an inside secret among some direct response marketers that if you studied the National Enquirer, you would be able to write headlines that would really get your prospects juiced up. Then suddenly this became mainstream knowledge, just not just among marketers, but especially among politicians and political, not blogs, but podcasts, right? And Now everyone's doing it, and you know, every single thumbnail I see on YouTube from anyone on any side of the political spectrum, and you know, every level of intelligence and reasonableness, including high intelligence and high reasonableness, from my point of view, they have these ridiculous clickbait titles, which they almost never pay off. You know, it's an exaggeration of what they imagine might happen as a result of what they're reporting, not actually what it is. And when it comes to ads and, you know, when it comes to emails and subject lines, clickbait sort of says you come from the wrong side of the tracks, you're not to be trusted, you know, count the silverware before the person leaves the house, right? I mean, it just has a greasy feel to it if you overdo it.
Well, and I will say, in YouTube thumbnails, shocking discovery, or total so-and-so gets owned, or totally demolished, those will work. They'll grab people's attention. They'll make people click. But if you don't actually deliver, if there's not actually a shocking discovery, next time I see you say shocking discovery, I'm going to be like, eh, last time I clicked, I was let down. Same thing, but even more so when it comes to email. If your email is shocking discovery, and then I click and there's no shocking discovery, next time you email me with that, I'm just going to send it straight to the wastebasket. And it is, I think the difference between what makes clickbait work and what makes clickbait not work is, when I click, do I actually get a delivery on the promise? And so many times people don't deliver on the promise, and the next time you make the promise, it's not as compelling.
Yeah, so there's two levels. I mean, you can use it and it does work. And if you use a little judgment and originality and discretion, it can work really well. That's step one. Step two is, you better damn well deliver or forget it.
Yep. Okay, so let's assume that we get people to actually open. They see who it's from. Your emails are getting delivered. The subject line was just enough curiosity without being too clickbaity, and they do open. Then we need to keep in mind, what kind of mindset are people in? What type of frame are people in when they're checking their emails nowadays?
Well, I would like it with, you know, if somebody comes home and they see there's an email from me, they tell the kids to go to their rooms, they turn off the music, turn off the TV, they dim the lights, maybe they put some essential oils out, and they say, oh, an email from David, and they read it very slowly. Maybe they even mouth the words, even though they're typically not mouth readers. No, that's not what happens at all. They read it when they're in line at the bank, right? They
generally
they might even read it while they're driving, which is really dangerous. Or, you know, they might read it at the doctor's office. They might read it while they're jogging. They might have Siri read it to them or some other app, you know?
Yep.
So the potential for distraction from your message is high, which means what? You don't want it to be long and involved, and you want it to kind of reach people at a visceral level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my tips on this, exactly. Generally, if someone's opening an email, like you said, they might be in line at the bank, they might be using the restroom real quick on a break from work, they might be in the middle of something and they get a notification, and they're like, oh, an email from David, let me check this out. But usually it's not time that I can sit down and read a full-on sales message. Usually it's just, I'm going to open this up and I'm going to treat my email like I would a social media notification. And so my rules for most emails, every once in a while I'll sprinkle in a long sales email, but for the most part, they're just lift emails, and we'll get into that in a second, but I'm going to try and keep them short, punchy. Here's the point. Here's why you should click through. And I'm not going to have big walls of text. Again, people are reading on their cell phones. A big medium-sized wall of text on the desktop is going to be a giant wall of text on the cell phone. So I'm going to make sure short, punchy, easy to read, bite-sized chunks of text, and get to the call to action quick as possible. And this is the big one. Only one call to action per email. I'm going to give you the one thing that you opened it to read, and then I'm going to give you one thing to do, which newsletters and old school affiliate marketing emails, we used to be able to put like 10 different clicks in there. Click here for this one. Click here for this one. Click here for this article. I have found that if I want you to do one thing, if I give you one other option, I reduce your possibility of doing that one thing by 50%. If I give you two other options, I reduce it by 66%. If I give you five different things to click on, now there's a 1 out of 5 chance that you're going to click on the one thing I really want you to click on. So one call to action at the end of the email.
Yeah, absolutely. People have a hard time with that. And they have a hard time with that because they actually think the numbers work the other way. They think, well, if I give people more choices, if they don't choose this one, then they'll choose that one. No, you'd be much better off sending them a different email with a different call to action. Yeah, there's a thing called decision fatigue, and you don't want to encourage it or, you know, cause it in your prospects by making them make more decisions than they have to buy from you.
Are you familiar with the jam experiment?
No.
So they've done experiments where they sample different jams at a grocery store, and they've done like 12 different jams to sample, and they saw more people sample, but less people buy. And then when they narrowed it down to three, these are our three top jams. Then when the people didn't have as many choices, they were more likely to actually walk out of the store with one of the jams. So we always think, give people options, give people choice. But when you narrow it down to three, that's why a lot of sales pages, pricing tables only have three options. And then if you look at them, they really only have one because one of them is highlighted. This is the best option, most popular. This is the one for you. So you give them the illusion of choice, but you're really only giving them one place to click. Same thing with our emails. We want to make sure we're only giving them one place to click.
Yeah, that's good. So let's talk about lift email types that you should be sending. We figured out how to get in the inbox, step one, how to get opened, step two, but what should be inside the emails?
Like I said earlier, I like to send out occasionally a direct sales email, straight up copywriting. Here's the problem. Here's the agitation. Here's the solution. Here's some proof that it works. Here's why you should trust me. Here's what you should do next. I'll send out emails like that occasionally. Most of the time, though, the email's not selling the thing. The email's just selling the click. Hey, here's what I want you to do next. Click here and find out more. So I would say 5 out of 6 of my emails don't even sell the thing in the email. They just sell the click. Joe from Agora.
Joe Schrieffer.
He was the one that kind of taught me the lift email technique. I think this is what they call it in-house, is lift emails. Mm-hmm. And it's just a quick email that gets the point across and says, hey, if you want more, go here to actually see the sales message. So types of emails that I will send out, besides just my direct sales emails, I love sending out help. You mentioned this earlier, helpful tip emails, where you open it up and you get a helpful tip. It helps you feel inspired, helps you feel empowered. Let you know, hey, if you want more of that feeling, here's where you need to click to get more. Avoiding pain point emails. Hey, this is the thing that people are really complaining about. Have you ever dealt with it? This is how bad it can get if you don't solve the problem in time. If you want more information on how to solve this problem, go here, check out what we've got for you. Goodwill emails. We do this with the podcast. Once a week, we've got a new episode. We don't want anything from you. We just want to give you a cool podcast to listen to. Here's what you're going to learn in it. Click here to go listen to it. You can do this like if you're finding, I know that you're subscribed to an email about AI and all of the different things with AI. And that's what they do. Hey, here's some cool stuff you need to know about what's going on in the AI world. I'm not trying to sell you anything. I just want you to go check out this cool thing that I found for you. Those type of emails will keep people opening. Story-based, again, plug for Persuasion Story Codes. Not a sponsor. Good story-based emails. Not always the hero's journey, but if you can tell good stories in your emails, that people love reading stories. If you can mix these type of emails, every single email isn't a sales email. If I know that four times out of five, when I open up your emails, I'm going to get an emotional reaction. I'm going to get a helpful tip. I'm going to get something that makes me feel inspired. I'm going to get something cool from you. If I know four out of five times I get something awesome, I'm just going to keep opening your emails. And then on the occasion that you do some hard selling in your emails, I'm going to stick around and read it, because you've trained me that opening and reading your emails gives me a reward.
Yeah, that's really good. I could not add much to that, except I think sometimes when I try and keep them tight, but sometimes when you're teaching or giving a tip, I think you can go longer than, you know, just, I don't know, maybe a story email or a pain email, because people appreciate that. I mean, you still have to be clear and simple and focused on one thing rather than 20 that you're teaching, and not be speaking in big, long $50 words, you know, but just keep it like you're talking to a friend, very simple and straightforward and practical. But yeah, I think the types of emails you talked about are just perfect. That's a perfect list.
Yeah, and I think that the thing that I really want to emphasize with this is the length on them can vary. Sometimes a story can be, if you catch me with a good story, I might read it for 10, 15 minutes. That's a long email, but I've read some of your emails that were pretty long and they were story-based, and I was hooked and I read it all the way through. It's not so much the length of the email, if you can actually keep people reading it, but the variety. If it's the same type of email, every time I see one of your emails, I know, oh, he's going to try and sell me something. He's going to try and sell me something. Or every time, if you just use the story-based emails over and over and over again, but it's the variety, it's the unexpected. Am I going to get a helpful tip? Am I going to get led on to some new secret in the industry that nobody knows about yet? Am I going to have an emotional roller coaster about the pain points I'm trying to avoid? The unexpectancy, if I don't know what I'm going to click or what I'm going to get on the other side of the click, but I know it's going to be something good, then I'm going to keep opening. So having the variety is the real important thing here.
Totally agree. And, you know, that's, I should make a note about that, because I'm not sure, even though we don't send a lot of sales emails, or we haven't, you know, with the persuasion story code list, they may be a little too similar, and I may need to change them up a little. Although I do get responses to them. People like them. So I think
that the persuasion story code, though, itself addresses this. If you're a marketer and every single time you tell a story, it's the hero's journey. So-and-so was dealing with this problem and they had to solve it so that they could get the desired result. And the hero found the mentor, and the mentor introduced him to this. And then they brought the solution back. If every single story in your marketing is the same story over and over and over again, it becomes boring. We need that variety. So just like the persuasion story code gives me a variety of different stories to use in my email marketing, I want to make sure that I'm using a variety of different types of emails to keep people reading.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. And thank you for not a sponsor, the persuasion story code, mentioning the persuasion story code. That's the persuasion story code available now at Amazon. Oh, sorry. All right. Final takeaway. Your email list is the only digital asset you truly own. Or, you know, what Evelina said, your email list is business insurance, which I thought was brilliant. Yeah. So do you want to give them the challenge, the call to action?
I will say this before we're out of here. Number one, your email list is building property on a foundation that you own rather than on a foundation that somebody else owns. So super important. But also, you want to make sure that you're investing in it properly. It's not just an asset that you have, because it's completely valueless unless you're doing the things that we talked about in today's episode. So I would say that's kind of my key takeaway from this. Also, in order to make sure, email. One of the biggest problems that I see people have with their email list is they have an onboarding sequence or a welcome sequence, and then people never hear from them after that, except for once every 3 or 4 months when people are trying to run a promotion. And that is the quickest way. It might be your insurance. It might be your only asset that you actually earn. But if you're not constantly investing in that asset, it's a worthless asset. If you're not constantly paying into the insurance, it's not valuable insurance. So email your people. Take the things that we taught you today and start emailing your list.
Yep. I second that emotion. Okay.
Okay, David, thank you for entertaining me on this one. It was a fun episode. I'm glad that we got to cover it. It's kind of like a back to the basics, but updated for 2025 and as important as ever.
For sure. Yeah, I enjoyed it too. Thanks for the idea.
All right. And if you enjoyed it, the listener out there with us in your ear holes, we've got lots of other ways to get in your ear hole, in your ear holes over at copywriterspodcast.com. You can check out 400 plus episodes of me and David bantering about copy over there, copywriterspodcast.com. And until next time, we will catch you later.
Catch you later. Stories are the most powerful way to get and hold a prospect's attention. Of course, you already know that. But the problem many of us have had is, even though stories are absolute magnets for getting attention, they don't do that much to advance the sale. That's because the way most of us have been taught to tell stories was not with persuasion in mind. I decided to change that. So I looked at what I had learned in studying story and writing copy for decades, as well as coaching all-star copywriters. What I had learned about stories that persuade, and I wrote a book. It's called The Persuasion Story Code. It tells you exactly how to create and use stories to move the sale forward. Lots of stories. I'm including examples of 25 different kinds with step-by-step guidelines for putting your own persuasion stories together. You can get The Persuasion Story Code on Amazon.com. Check it out. You'll be glad you did.